Good evening. The IMF says the world is heading into one of the greatest crises in history. Cuba and Russia help as the United States goes on a war footing, and sailors on an aircraft carrier cheer a captain who is relieved of command. With these and other stories, I'm Paul D'Arienzo with some of the news for Friday, April 3rd, 2020. In one of the most aggressive steps yet in the United States to relieve severe shortages of equipment needed to fight the coronavirus scourge, Governor Andrew Cuomo announced he'll use his authority to seize ventilators and protective gear from private hospitals and companies that aren't using them. If they want to sue me for borrowing their excess ventilators to save lives, let them sue me, said Cuomo. The governor said New York, the worst hotspot in the nation, would run out of ventilators next week, while Louisiana's governor said New Orleans would exhaust its supply by Tuesday. The number of the people infected in the U.S. exceeded 250,000, and the death toll climbed past 6,600, with New York State alone accounting for more than 2,900 dead, an increase of over 560 in just one day. Most of the dead are in New York City, where hospitals are getting swamped with patients. About 15,000 people were hospitalized statewide, most of them in the city. As of Tuesday, the World Health Organization reported 896,450 confirmed COVID-19 cases and 45,526 deaths. According to the WHO, the official count could reach 1 million cases in the next 2 days and 50,000 deaths by tomorrow. The U.S. CDC reported 213,144 cases and 4,513 deaths as of Tuesday. 10 states have reported more than 5,000 cases, and 26 states have reported widespread community transmission. Yesterday, President Trump invoked the Defense Production Act twice to secure production of respirators and mechanical ventilators to support the COVID-19 response. Meanwhile, New York City officials said Friday, in 24 hours, the number of coronavirus cases jumped by more than 4,400, with over 180 new deaths. The city had 52,948 confirmed COVID-19 cases and 1,584 deaths. Among the deaths, Arlene Stringer Cuevas, a former city councilwoman in the 1970s and mother of comptroller Scott Stringer. She passed away Friday morning from complications of the coronavirus. In Ecuador, reportedly citizens under restrictive social distancing measures have been unable to obtain care for family members sick with the disease, while police in Guayaquil have been assigned to retrieve the bodies of COVID-19 victims who die outside of hospitals. The Russian Ministry of Health reported a total of 4,149 cases, an increase of 17% from the previous day, and more than double the number reported on March 30th. Iran reported 53,183 confirmed cases of COVID-19, including 3,294 deaths. Spain is now approaching a total of 117,710 cases and 10,935 deaths, which overtakes Italy for the second most cases, behind only the United States. And a grim snapshot of the U.S. job market's sudden collapse emerged Friday with a report that employers shed hundreds of thousands of jobs last month because of the viral outbreak. The loss of 701,000 jobs reported by the Labor Department ended nearly a decade of uninterrupted job growth, the longest such streak on record. But even with these staggering losses, the threat to the U.S. economy pales in comparison to the effect on the developing world. Kristalina Georgieva is head of the International Monetary Fund. She says the current situation marks the world's darkest hour.
We are now in recession. It is way worse than the global financial crisis. And it is a crisis that requires all of us to come together. The IMF is there to protect the health of the world economy. United, we can do our duties. Saving lives and protecting livelihoods ought to go hand in hand. We cannot do one without the other. We at the IMF are concentrated on making sure that there is a strong response to the health crisis, as well as protecting the strength of the economy. My second point is about emerging markets and developing economies. They are hard hit, and they have very often less resources to protect themselves against this dual crisis, health and economic crisis. We know that in many countries, health systems are weak. We know that in flight to safety, a lot of capital has left the emerging economies, the developing world. Nearly $90 billion have flown out. This is way more than during the global financial crisis. And some countries are highly dependent on commodity exports, with prices collapsing, they're hit yet again. It is paramount for us to place these countries, and especially the weakest among them, in the center of our attention. The same way the virus hits vulnerable people with medical preconditions hardest, the economic crisis hits vulnerable economies the hardest. We are mobilizing emergency financing assistance to countries, and I can tell you we have never seen ever such a growing demand for emergency financing. Already over 90 countries have been placing requests to the IMF for it. This is, in my lifetime, humanity's darkest hour, a big threat to the whole world. And it requires from us to stand tall, be united, and protect the most vulnerable of our fellow citizens on this planet.
Kristalina Georgieva is head of the International Monetary Fund. Economist Jack Rasmus says the hit the world economy is taking will put pressure on the richer companies to help, but at a time their own economies are suffering and nationalist leaders like Trump are in ascendancy.
I'm very negative on what's going to happen in emerging market economies. Their currencies are going to continue to collapse. They're not going to be able to get the currency to purchase imports, needed imports. The global slowdown and recession in a global economy is going to mean they can't sell their exports. China used to be a big buyer of commodities from emerging markets. It's not going to be that buyer again. Emerging markets, meaning outside China, Japan, Korea, U.S., Europe, are in the worst shape, I believe, for a recovery here and for a continued depth of the decline. Next serious is probably Japan and Europe, and then next serious after that, the U.S. and China.
Is this the world basically being knocked back into a economic dark age? We're going to go back to the days when there was even more poverty than there is today.
That all depends what the responses are here. If they're smart enough, the leaders, the capitalists of these countries, to pump fiscal spending directly into the economies, then it won't be as serious. You know, they're going to have to do something like FDR's New Deal, where for various means you created jobs. Maybe even the government's going to have to hire people itself. That whole stimulus aimed at the households has to occur, because stimulus aimed at business is not going to bring anything back if the households don't come back and purchase those goods. Hopefully they'll understand that, but you can't be sure. There's some pretty dumb people up there now.
With the president that we have and the leadership that we have, their America First approach to the world, whatever that means, I mean, he's spending more time sending ships to threaten Venezuela and Iran and then firing captains of aircraft carriers when they say that they might have dozens of deaths on their ship from the coronavirus. What kind of leadership is that?
Well, that's no leadership is what it is. And you know, this guy thinks if you give money to businesses, more tax cuts, we already gave $4 trillion to him, that's somehow going to stimulate it all. And yes, the risk is very great that he'll try to cause a big diversion. The likely candidate is probably Venezuela. He'll probably try to blockade Venezuela and provoke it. Iran is a possibility here as well. This is a classic when these politicians are in deep trouble. They turn to a foreign policy adventure here to redirect people's attention. That's very real, I think, and that probably will happen as things get worse.
last point, would that save? I mean, the U.S. doesn't have a great track record of winning these kind of wars, and if that fails, what happens?
You know, it probably won't fail till after the election. It'll get him the votes he needs for the election. He's going to do anything he needs to wreck the economy, wreck the global peace, stability to get election. That's all this guy cares about is being reelected. And he's clearly bringing people around him who aren't qualified. I mean, you know, putting Jared Kushner in charge. What the hell does he know? It's really a very unstable period we're moving into here, politically as well as economically.
Economist Jack Rasmus of St. Mary's College in California. And you're listening to the news on WBAI New York. I'm Paul DiRienzo. President Trump announced this week he'd launch anti-drug operations in the Venezuelan Caribbean and other seas in the Western Hemisphere in the middle of the coronavirus pandemic as part of the national security plan. Jorge Rodriguez, Venezuela's communication minister, called the deployment a desperate attempt to distract attention from the tragic humanitarian crisis in the U.S. caused by the coronavirus. But that didn't stop Trump, Secretary of State Mark Esper, and Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff General Mark Milley from denouncing Venezuela as supporters of an attempt to flood the United States with drugs during the pandemic, allegations made without evidence.
Today, the United States launching enhanced counter-narcotics operations in the Western Hemisphere to protect the American people from the deadly scourge of illegal narcotics. We must not let the drug cartels exploit the pandemic to threaten American lives. In cooperation with the 22 partner nations, U.S. Southern Command will increase surveillance, disruption, and seizures of drug shipments and provide additional support for eradication efforts, which are going on right now at a record pace. We're deploying additional Navy destroyers, combat ships, aircraft and helicopters, Coast Guard cutters, and Air Force surveillance aircraft, doubling our capabilities in the region. Very importantly, our forces are fully equipped with personnel, protective equipment, and we've taken additional safety measures to ensure our troops remain healthy. So I'm going to ask Mark to start.
Today, at the President's direction, the Department of Defense, in close cooperation with our interagency partners, began enhanced counter-narcotics operations in the Eastern Pacific Ocean and the Caribbean Sea. This initiative is part of the administration's whole-of-government approach to combating the flow of illicit drugs into the United States and protecting the American people from their scourge. Furthermore, corrupt actors like the illegitimate Maduro regime in Venezuela rely on the profits derived from the sale of narcotics to maintain their oppressive hold on power. Drug traffickers are seizing on this lawlessness by increasing their illicit activities. We must do more to prevent these drugs from arriving at our shores. The enhanced operations we are announcing today will keep the pressure on these criminal groups and protect the American people from the devastation caused by the flow of illegal drugs into our country.
We came upon some intelligence some time ago that the drug cartels, as a result of COVID-19, are going to try to take advantage of the situation and try to infiltrate additional drugs into our country. As we know, the 70,000 Americans die on an average annual basis to drugs. That's unacceptable. We're at war with COVID-19, we're at war with terrorists, and we are at war with the drug cartels as well. This is the United States military. You will not penetrate this country. You will not get past Jump Street. You're not going to come in here and kill additional Americans, and we will marshal whatever assets are required to prevent your entry into this country to kill Americans.
And while the United States is sending warships and troops, some of its rivals are sending doctors, equipment, and medicine to help stricken countries, including the United States. A giant AN-124 Russian military transport plane landed at Kennedy International Airport in New York this week, bringing cartons of masks and ventilators from Russia for a pandemic-stricken metropolis. The Russian military said last week that it had also dispatched at least 15 plane loads of medical equipment and personnel to help Italy fight the virus. Not all the aid has been welcome. Brazil, whose far-right president, Jair Bolsonaro, expelled most of Cuba's 10,000 doctors from the country and branded them terrorists, disguised in uniforms. Not that Bolsonaro isn't helping himself. After lashing out at his health minister because he does not have a humble attitude, Brazil's president on Thursday announced that he and other religious leaders will perform a fast as a form of sacrifice to rid Brazil of the COVID-19 pandemic. Paradoxically, after minimizing the importance of the small flu for weeks, Bolsonaro likened the pandemic to a war. Dan Kovalik is author of No More War, How the West Violates International Law by Using Humanitarian Intervention to Advance Economic and Strategic Interests.
Quite shameful, really. You know, when you see Cuba sending doctors around the world and you see China sending personnel and supplies around the world to fight the virus. Meanwhile, the U.S. has pulled all of its Peace Corps volunteers out of foreign countries, brought them all home, but is sending warships to the coast of Venezuela. While the rest of the world seems to be banding together to fight this virus, the U.S. seems to be exploiting the situation to topple governments that it doesn't like.
Is this something that would have happened whoever was president, Obama or Clinton and the rest of them?
What Trump is doing is certainly in keeping with what Obama did. We have to remember that Obama twice declared Venezuela a unique security threat to the United States. At one point, when asked about it, he laughed and basically said, well, I have to say that in order to be able to sanction them. I mean, he made it clear that that was that designation had no basis in fact, and he did sanction them twice, and Trump has only upped the sanctions and upped the pressure. So I would certainly say this is a continuation of the policy of Obama, which was a continuation of George W.'s policy also of trying to topple at that time Hugo Chavez.
Let's talk about the positive things that are happening as far as Cuba and some of these other countries.
I mean, we have to call out the person whose idea it was, and that was Fidel Castro. I mean, his idea was, he made it clear, we're not going to send bombs around the world. We're going to send doctors around the world. And Cuba has. Cuba, at any given time, has doctors in 70 or so countries in the world right now. As I understand it, they have countries specifically in 31 countries to fight the COVID-19 pandemic. And they've also apparently developed a drug that even Newsweek called a wonder drug to fight COVID-19, which was used in China very effectively, is being used in Italy. But this was all done very intentionally years ago. Again, it was Fidel's idea to develop their international medical capacity, and they've done it, and they're exercising that type of solidarity right now.
Now, didn't the U.S. just recently threaten countries that accepted doctors from Cuba and call on countries not to accept aid from Cuba and other countries like that?
Yes, they've done that a number of different times, and they've done it very recently, even during this pandemic. They've threatened countries and told them not to accept Cuban doctors. The U.S. really is trying to interfere in Cuba's medical mission. And why? I mean, frankly, because it sets a bad example as far as the U.S. is concerned.
And it's a sad situation. So the U.S. is not really stepping up. I mean, the U.S. is an America first, you know, the America first ideology of the Trump administration specifically means not giving foreign aid.
First of all, let's get our own house in order. Don't tell me what other countries aren't doing to stop the pandemic. Tell us what our government is doing to stop the pandemic. We may end up having more cases and more deaths than any country in the world, as things appear right now. And we're not minding our own store. So why are we going out and engaging in attempted regime change in places like Iran and Venezuela? And by the way, I have to mention for the record that the U.S.'s own statistics belie Trump's claim that Venezuela is a drug traffic conduit. About 94% of the cocaine we get in this country comes from Colombia, South America, people would not be surprised to hear, which is a very close ally of the United States. But instead of threatening Colombia, not that I would urge that, or instead of cutting off military aid to Colombia, we're threatening Venezuela militarily.
Will this gangster type of mentality, what kind of way is that to run a country?
Well, it is not a way to run the country. Again, this is a time, if there's ever been a time, for the world to come together, try to deal with this pandemic in a cooperative fashion. This is not the time to be strong-arming other countries. And yet that's exactly what we see is happening. And I agree, it does look like a gangster. It does look like a mafia-type operation to isolate and get rid of the little store owner that isn't tithing to you. In this case, that's Iran and Venezuela. That it is a mafia-type operation. The U.S. has run those type of operations for decades.
Is there anything people can do?
There are 11 senators who have called for the end of sanctions, the end of all U.S. sanctions against other countries during this pandemic. I think minimally we should join in those calls. We should put pressure on our congresspeople, our senators, to end these sanctions regimes against countries like Iran and Venezuela and Cuba and Nicaragua, and urge the congresspeople at the same time to put the reins in on U.S. military expansion right now during this pandemic.
Dan Kovalik is author of No More War, How the West Violates International Law by Using Humanitarian Intervention to Advance Economic and Strategic Interests. And finally, sailors aboard the USS Theodore Roosevelt aircraft carrier cheered for Captain Brett Crozier as he disembarked the ship for the last time, an overwhelming show of support for their leader, who was relieved of his command after issuing a stark warning about a coronavirus outbreak on board.
Oh, here it is. That's how you send out one of the greatest captains you ever had. The GOAT, the man for the people.
He was relieved of command for showing poor judgment days after writing a memo warning Navy leadership that decisive action was needed to save the lives of the ship's crew. Acting Secretary of the Navy Thomas Modly announced on Thursday.
It is not an indictment of character, but rather of judgment. While I do take issue with the validity of some of the points in Captain Crozier's letter, he was absolutely correct in raising them. It was the way in which he did it, by not working through and with his strike group commander to develop a strategy to resolve the problems he raised, by not sending the letter to and through his chain of command and to people outside his chain of command, by not protecting the sensitive nature of the information contained within the letter appropriately, and lastly, by not reaching out to me directly to voice his concerns after that avenue had been clearly provided to him through my team, that was unacceptable to me. This duty requires courage, but it also requires a respect for that chain of command and a respect for the sensitivity of the information you decide to share and the manner in which you choose to share it. I would like to send a message to the crew of the Theodore Roosevelt and their families back here at home. I am entirely convinced that your commanding officer loves you and that he had you at the center of his heart and mind in every decision that he has made. I also know that you have great affection and love for him as well. But it is my responsibility to ensure that his love and concern for you is matched, if not exceeded by, his sober and professional judgment under pressure. Our adversaries need to know this as well. They respect and fear the big stick, and they should. We will not allow anything to diminish that respect and fear as you and the rest of our nation fights through this virus.
And how do you respond to some of the families and some of the sailors on the ship who say he was just speaking truth to power?
The families of the sailors want the CO to be looking out for the well-being of the sailors. We have a responsibility to look out for them as well, but also for to guard our national security mission and all the other sailors that are out on all the other ships out there that may be put at risk by the actions of a particular commanding officer. So that's the bottom line for me.
Did you not receive the letter before it appeared in the paper? Did it not go up the chain of command? And how does this not have a chilling effect on other Navy captains?
I trust that it won't have a chilling effect. I hope that what this will do, it will reinforce the fact that we have the proper way of handling this. What he did by doing this and not being careful with who that information went to, and you're right, it did go to the task group commander, to Admiral Aquilino, to the air boss, but it was copied to 20 or 30 other people. Okay? Okay. That's just not acceptable. It created a panic on the ship, because the ship was not prepared. The chief petty officers were not prepared to answer questions from the crew in terms of how bad the situation was. The reality of what's happening on the ship right now is we have about 114 sailors who have tested positive. I can tell you with great certainty there's going to be more. They'll probably be in the hundreds. Of the 114 sailors, not a single one of them has been hospitalized or has had the requirement to be hospitalized. They're all, the ones that are sick are exhibiting mild or moderate flu symptoms. Some of them are exhibiting no symptoms, and some of them have already recovered from the virus, from the effects of the virus.
Is he really being relieved because he CC'd too many people on this letter? That's what it kind of makes it seem like.
So when I have a commanding officer who's responsible for a nuclear-powered aircraft carrier with all that lethality and all that responsibility, who exercises that poor judgment in a situation, in a crisis like this. Now, granted, they don't train for this, but we expect more from our COs than what they train for.
Give us a sense of where the emails went. Did it go to civilians, family members, the press, the numbers, and where this
I'm
went.
Not going to comment on that.
Thank you, ladies and gentlemen.
Because you don't know or you don't
know? No, I know.
Right.
I know. I'm not going to comment on that.
Well, lastly, just one more. You said some of the things he said in the letter were correct, but I think you said the language he used was just not something you would have. Can you expand on that? What was in his letter that?
Well, I think you raise a particular level of alarm when you say that 50 people on the crew are going to die. Okay? No one knows that to be true.
Were you already planning to take 3,000 sailors off the ship when he sent the letter, or is that only as a result of his letter?
That's how the strategy evolved once the ship got in place. That's correct. We determined we were going to take a very methodical approach to this. As I mentioned to you before, the ship requires a certain number of people to man it. It's got two nuclear power plants on it. It's got weapons. It's got ammunition. You have to have a certain number of people on there. It's about 10% of the ship at any one time. But you can't have all those 10% of the people on. You have to have a watch rotation. So it's about 700-800 people to 1,000 people that you need to have ready. So we took those people off first, the people that we could fill those bills, make sure that they're clean, and we'll slowly start bringing them back on the ship. In the meantime, we freed up 1,700 additional hotel rooms in the state of Guam to take people off faster. And this was all in the works when this was going on. And that's going to be the last question. Okay? Thank you.
Thank you,
Honor. As of Friday morning, 137 sailors from the Roosevelt have tested positive for the virus, representing more than 10% of all cases across the U.S. military. And that's some of the news for Friday, April 3rd, 2020. The news was produced with Linda Perry. Our engineer is Reggie Johnson. For the WBAI News, I'm Paul DiRienzo.